You're listening to the Vint Podcast, where we bring you interviews and stories from around the world of wine and spirits. From winemakers and critics to sommeliers and master distillers, we'll explore the people and businesses who are instrumental in shaping the future of today's food and drinks culture. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Vint Podcast. We're fast approaching our 100th episode, which maybe one of these days we'll have some information to share on what we have in store for listeners for our episode 100, but it's sneaking up on us. How you doing, Billy?
Doing very well. It's going to be surreal. It's weird to think that we've been doing this for almost 100 episodes and all the guests that we've had on, but it's really exciting. And surprisingly, this is one of the few Australian guests or Australian focused episodes and Australian, I guess, leaning guests. They're American, but the topic's all Australian. So it's surprising to me that we haven't talked about it more.
Yeah, that's right. We only recently got into doing more whiskey specific episodes and producers, and we have found North on. And so I guess it makes sense that we haven't touched Australia yet, but we definitely need to get more into some of these. It's almost terrible to call them emerging, but in terms of the how well the U.S. wine market understands some of these other regions, we should definitely get into those.
Well, this is what happens when you have almost 100 episodes. We have had one Australian focused episode. It was the guy from Wines of Australia. We had a Penfolds episode. So we've had two. So I forget. No, we had a Wines of Australia guy representative as well. I can't remember his name. Sorry for forgetting. But yeah, but this one, what I really enjoyed about this. So we have Jane Lopez is on to discuss her new book that she came out with her husband. That's called How to Drink Australian. How to Drink Australian. I always want to say what we're drinking Australian. And it's basically like all of the things and more that I've tried to explain to all of my friends after coming back from Australia and experiencing all the amazing wines. And it's so hard to articulate. And they came out with this book that basically condenses everything I wanted to say and obviously builds way more on that in a really approachable and aesthetically pleasing manner.
Yeah, it's her husband, Jonathan Ross. So it's Jane Lopez, our guest today, and Jonathan Ross, her husband, put together a wonderful book, both in terms of its utility as a reference book for Australian wines, but also for the lay drinker, as we'll talk about someone who can come in and get the skinny on a region just by thumbing through a little bit. It's also a beautiful book. But I think it's funny we say, I think in the past, you might hand someone a bottle of Penfolds and be like, here, try this. It's Australian wine, which we would never do, even in the States. We wouldn't say, this is a United States wine. The diversity in Australia, which she expands on, I think, here, really should allow us to be more specific when we talk about Australian wine in the future and not just bucket in everything into kind of one description, because there is so much diversity in Australia, probably even more diversity than half of the United States.
Yeah,
in terms of winemaking.
And what I also love is they have these little icons that tell you like if it's a legendary producer or a must visit or environmentally friendly. And what I think is really cool there's 8 of these icons, maybe more. And there are things that I wouldn't have guessed unless you have to be on the ground to really get this knowledge. So there's a producer called Rockford, for example. I was down there and basically people would be like, there's 3 top wines. And I've heard this many times. It's like Penfolds Grange, Henschke Hill of Grace, and then they would always say Rockford Basket Press. That was their, in terms of their echelons of big red Australian wines, the best in the country, that was theirs. And I had never heard of it. But like if you read this book, you get to see that it's a legendary wine and it's an icon in the area. So I think it's that kind of like on the ground insight that you're really getting that's really interesting. And a random fun fact, as soon as we had this episode, somebody placed an order on the Vint Marketplace for a case of Rockford Basket Press, which they've never done before. I was like, what a small world. It's like the universe is listening.
That's right. Yeah. And I think probably the reason for that and the reason a book like this is so helpful is because so low a percentage of the wines in Australia actually end up, I should say it this way. So many of the great producers in Australia don't end up outside of Australia. And so it's certainly owes to that. And yeah, it's great to have not one, but 2 folks who have been on the ground working in high-end restaurants, discovering the wines of the region. And yeah, so it was awesome to have Jane on.
Yeah. And we failed to mention that both her and her husband are master sommeliers. So they know what they're talking about. And they also are trying to change that availability of Australian wines. They have an import company called Legends that is bringing over some of my favorite producers from Australia and some of these names that are really hard to get currently. And so everybody should go to their website, check out their portfolio and see where you can find those wines, as well as buy the book. Maybe buy the book first, and that'll help inform the wines that you want to go check out and drink. But yeah, I think, go ahead.
I would guess that probably 90, 95% of even self-claimed wine enthusiasts had never had a wine from Tasmania, for instance. So exploring and drinking wines from Australia is a great way to introduce unique experiences to your wine drinking, tell unique stories to your friends who you're drinking with. Super cool.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe if you guys are lucky, I will have a what we're drinking this weekend specifically on Australian wine. That will be TBD. But in the meantime, please go check out the book. It's called How to Drink Australian. And here is Jane Lopez to talk about the book further. Hi, Jane. I'm really excited. I'm sure I will have rambled about this in the intro too, but to meet somebody who, or talk to somebody who's really bringing Australian wine and all of its nuances to a broader audience, especially to Americans, it's always great to spread the good word that I don't think is very well spread yet.
It is not. And it's, we're fighting the good fight, but we appreciate others who get it, who've been there and who understand all the good things going on and all.
Yeah. So before we dive into kind of how you ended up in Australia, because clearly your accent is not Australian, do you want to give us a little bit of background on how you got into wine and then landed in Australia?
Yeah. I went to school. I got a degree in English literature. Specifically, I studied Renaissance drama, very practical undergraduate degree. And I was planning to go into academia. I was going to go apply to PhD programs, but just was taking a year off and needed a job. And I was on Craigslist and saw a listing to work in a wine shop. And I thought that would be fun. I knew almost nothing about wine. I had started drinking wine when I studied abroad in Italy my junior year in college and just really loved the culture around wine and loved it was really part of the meal. And it was a very sort of social community oriented thing. But yeah, didn't know much, but they gave me the job anyway. And I never turned in those grad school applications, just stuck with wine. And yeah, I ended up, that was in Chicago. I worked at that retailer for about 4 years while also doing some bartending. And then moved to Nashville, Tennessee to help open a restaurant there as the wine director. Then moved to New York, where I worked in sort of sommelier jobs. And that's where I met my now husband, Jonathan Ross. We worked at 11 Medicine Park together. And in late 2016, I got a job offer to run the wine program at a restaurant called Attica in Melbourne, Australia. And neither John nor I had ever been to Australia before, but we said, why not? Let's move to Australia. And so, yeah, that is how two Americans ended up in Australia. And we were just really blown away by the quality of Australian wine and how little of it came to the U.S. Only about 10% of Australian wineries export to the U.S. So what we see here is just this very narrow vision of what's going on over there. So we've set out to change that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh, go ahead, Brady.
Sorry, I just pulled up. I was looking at the Attica website. What's the, can you just give us the skinny on what the sort of concept was at Attica?
Yeah, Attica is sort of quintessential Australian restaurant in a way that really wasn't defined before them. I think, interesting enough, the chef Ben Shuri is actually from New Zealand originally, but has lived in Australia all of his adult life. And he really wanted to create a restaurant that kind of pay reverence to every aspect of Australian cuisine. And so a lot of native ingredients, like things you would have never heard of, like lily pilli and courgette and sort of these native fruits and seeds and herbs. And then there's a lot of really unique shellfish in particular to Australia. But then there's also, we had kangaroo on the menu quite frequently. But then he also often would pay homage to Australian food culture and more kind of modern food culture in terms of like takes on meat pies and pavlova and stuff like that, like very modern Australian food. And it was just very whimsical and fun and beautiful. And yeah, very, very special restaurant.
That's awesome.
Yeah, good. I was going to say, I lived in Melbourne for like 4 months of my time after Vintage, and I never made it quite down to Attica. I lived in the CBD, but I've heard amazing things. I can't imagine what it would be like to just go from not really knowing much about all of these kind of random ingredients. Although once you learn about kangaroo, it doesn't taste that weird. I actually really enjoyed kangabangas, as they had like sausages made of kangaroo. But was it a transition to start pairing with those types of things? Or is it it's really the flavors that are generated that you're like working with that kind of led to, yeah, your...
Totally. And so it was definitely really new for me, but a lot of those ingredients would be really foreign to Australian sommeliers too. They just aren't particularly widespread. And certainly when Ben started using them, they really weren't at all in circulation. Yeah, it's always a different process to get to know a new chef's food and how they season and how they think about the balance of acidity and salt and sweetness and all those things. And pairing with Ben's food was a real delight, because the balance was really conducive to working well with wine, and I just had a whole new set of wines at my fingertips too, in terms of all of these amazing Australian wines that I'd never seen or tasted before. So there was definitely a learning curve to get used to the food, and certainly to wrap my head around all the wines, but yeah, a pretty exciting learning curve too.
What's the culture like among Australian locals with regard to Australian wines? You said that only about 10% of the wines come out of Australia. So is there a pretty strong affinity for Australians around their wine culture and the wineries of the region? Or is there a lot of outward focus to the regions that we commonly think about in Europe and elsewhere? What's sort of that culture like?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of pride of Australian wine, and especially regionally. We'd sometimes get people in the restaurant from like Tasmania, and they're like, refuse to drink anything but Tasmanian wine. But there definitely is a wide set of wines from the rest of the world. They're expensive. And not only are you paying, of course, the money to get European or American wine around the world to Australia, there's pretty heavy taxes that if you're an Australian winery with below 5 million in annual sales, you get a rebate on it's called the wine equalization tax, wet tax, as 29%. So there's really a great incentive to drink small production domestic producers, because those are always going to be the best value. So yeah, there's all sorts of wine from around the world available, but we found ourselves really gravitating toward Australian wine just because it represented a great value and it was so new to us. And I think a lot of Australians end up not seeing a reason to deviate from just drinking great Australian wine.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I was there, that's what I heard most, was like, why would we drink these other ones that are more expensive when our country produces such a wide range of wines? If I want like a cool, crisp, lean wine, I'll get a Tasmanian wine. If I want like a big red, I'll go to Barossa. If I want a medium body cab, I'll go to Coonawarra. So And I will say also, one interesting thing when I was there is like even the biggest wine shops, like 70% would be Australian wines. And then the latter third would be the whole rest of the world combined. And I always thought that was interesting, because they were like, well, why not? We have all the styles you need right here.
Totally, totally. Australia really has, in our experience, the most diversity of production of any single wine producing country in the world. Mm-hmm. If you want a great Nebbiolo, you can get it. If you want a great Tempranillo, you can get it. There really is just almost everything grape wise and almost everything climate wise. There's some real kind of alpine regions, real Mediterranean, maritime, high elevation, coastal, whatever climate you could imagine for wine growing, they have it in Australia. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's a great thing. It's funny. Melbourne definitely, I think, embraces Australian wine a little bit more than Sydney does. When you go to Sydney, that ratio is mm-hmm. flipped for the Melbourne wine. But to be fair, Melbourne is so close to dozens of great wine regions, and maybe not dozens, but a dozen. And Sydney is doesn't have that same sort of density of wine regions right around it.
Yeah, no shade on Hunter Valley, but if that was what was right next door, I wouldn't drink as much Australian wine either.
Yeah, and it's not even next door. It's still 2.5 hour drive, I think, maybe three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a really annoying bus tour up there, and it did take forever to get there. But when we got there, it was cool. But so how did you guys go about? Was it through work, or did you drive around and just go discover these regions? Because clearly it rubbed off on both of you guys, because you started an import company, and then also the impetus of our podcast. You guys wrote a whole book on how to drink Australian. What led you down the full falling in love and making sure you wanted to bring this back to the U.S.?
Yeah, we did drive around and hit a bunch of wine regions. And at first it was just curiosity as sommeliers. But at some point, I don't know exactly when the transition was, but we started thinking like, man, it's just a real shame that these wines aren't in the U.S. And hey, maybe we're well situated to do it. And we have the relationships in Australia with producers. We have the experience in the American wine industry. We're both new to not only imports, but just kind of distribution and wholesale in general. So there was definitely a steep learning curve in that respect. But yeah, just the more wines we tasted, and it honestly is, if we had the distribution, we have 34 producers in our portfolio, so pretty substantial. But if we had the distribution networks and the demand existed, like, we could double that tomorrow exclusively with producers. We were just so pumped about it breaks our hearts. We've had to say no or not yet to a handful of producers who've reached out to us, whose wines we adore and who we think deserve to be over here. But the market just, it takes a while to change and for people's minds to change about Australian wine. And ultimately, and unfortunately, there just isn't demand right now in the U.S. for premium Australian wine. No one's walking into a wine shop or a restaurant and saying, where's your Australian wine section? And if they are, they're probably looking for exclusively maybe three producers of big, bold Shiraz. And that's not a knock on those producers at all. It's just, it would be great if that was one thing that people were seeking out, but that also people walked in and said, oh, I really love, I've had some Adelaide Hills Chardonnays that I really love. What do you have for Adelaide Hills Chardonnay? Or I really love Yura Valley Cabernet. What do you have for that? Right. And that's our goal, is just to change. And it's a lofty goal, and it will take some time, but we want to create demand in the market for these wines.
Well, yeah, people aren't walking into shops and asking those questions. And I have my own ideas about maybe what people's preconceived, or what my own preconceived notions about Australian wine is, because just like many people, I don't drink super broadly in Australia. But how would you characterize, just sort of as you put together this project, what the common perception of Australian wine is here in the U.S. in terms of what people think they're getting when they drink Australian?
I think there's plenty of people who think Australian wine is cheap wine, who associate Australian wine with Yellowtail and Jacob's Creek and maybe 19 Crimes. although I don't think actually many people know that's Australian. And so there's this idea that Australian wine is grocery store wine. And if you look at some of the educational materials for WSET or quartermaster sommeliers, they often like lead with that idea that here's this bulk wine producing country, but oh, there's a little bit of good wine made. Huh. And that's just not true. Because of the tax structure I mentioned, there's this gap in terms of sizes of wineries where it doesn't make sense. If you're going to make the decision to go over that kind of tax threshold where you get that rebate, you're going to make the decision to go big. And so you do have this kind of handful of big producers, but Australia is actually dominated by small, medium-sized producers. And even the big producers aren't as big as many places in the world. Like Australia as a whole makes less wine than Mendoza, Argentina, makes less wine than the Languedoc in France. Australia only has about four times the plantings of just Champagne. And Riverina, where Yellowtail is, they're actually about a 30% smaller wine region than Champagne. And here's a appellation that we think of as boutique and premium, and it certainly is in some respects, but it also isn't in other respects. And they've been able to hold those two identities, or really just hold the one identity for premium wine. And Australia, unfortunately, has just gotten cast as this bulk producing kind of cheap wine country. So I think that's one perception that people have. And then I think the other perception will probably be that people just don't like the wines because they've only had a few styles. The most common styles you see in the U.S. are either sort of big, bold red wine, usually Shiraz, sometimes Cabernet, or pretty lean white wine, right? Your clear Eden Valley Riesling, Hunter Valley Semillon. And so that's what Australia is known for. And a lot of places you go wouldn't have any other options besides those, if even those. So there's this perception of, oh yeah. And honestly, we felt this way before we moved there. It was like, okay, yeah, I don't think we love Australian wine, but we're curious to explore. And there's just so much more than these kind of handful of styles and grapes made in a commercial way, which is the predominantly what the U.S. gets to see.
How helpful or unhelpful, or I guess you can interpret this question the way that you want to. Most people's first introduction to premium Australian wine here in the U.S. is maybe a producer like Penfolds. Yeah. And as you said, the style of wines from the Australian portfolio from that producer, are within a certain kind of down the middle of the bullseye in terms of what you might think of these Syrah and Cabernet-based red wines. How helpful or unhelpful do you think producers like Penfolds are in getting people to drink more broadly in Australia, or vice versa, maybe turn them away from the bio?
Yeah, Penfolds is a great company. They make a lot of great wines. They make a lot of wine. I think the problem lies in that there just hasn't been much else that has been able to infiltrate the market, because every country has its kind of bigger producers, but we don't judge all of French wine by Louis Jadot. And it's been sort of a series of factors. Australian wine was really having a pretty good heyday in the US in the early 2000s, of course, with sort of like Parker Point sort of wines, but also some interesting, and not to shit on those wines, but just some different stuff was also coming to the market and was starting to get some traction. And then sort of 2007 hit, global financial crisis, and Australia was actually going through a mining boom at that time. So their currency was really strong. So all of a sudden, people don't have money to spend on wine as much as they did in the US. And you have Australian wines are 50% more expensive, if not more than that. So almost everything fell out. And the only things that could afford to weather the storm were those bigger brands, whether it's Penfolds or Molly Duker or Yellowtail. So it's normally a country's reputation is built on much more than a few producers. But in the case of Australia, you really went through a period where that was it in the US. And so it was just sort of this confluence of conditions. And most Australian wineries just said, even when things sort of turned around and there was this idea that you could go back to the US, most Australian wineries, especially those who got burned in the mid-2000s, just said no thanks and we'd rather export to other markets that aren't as difficult as the US market is and where we don't have such a uphill battle. So yeah, I think producers have put their faith in us and at least we're trying, and at least we know how to speak about Australia. And I think there's also, it helps when there's a personal connection and people know that we have integrity and we're going to pay them. And we managed to get a lot of great producers to come on board with us. And we're not 100% where we'd like to be, of course. And I think it's still definitely an uphill battle to create demand rather than just supply existing demand. But we really believe it's worth it to expand the US's horizon for Australian wine.
Yeah, and to your point earlier, it's really important that this kind of movement happens on from the ground up, with folks walking into wine shops, trusting the owner or person behind the counter and getting a recommendation for these kinds of wines. That's, I think I saw Stargazer in y'all's portfolio, and I was introduced to Stargazer by the local wine shop, an MS friend that owns a shop in Richmond. And so, yeah, I definitely think that that's going to be a crucial part of getting this to catch on, right?
Totally. I think the bigger outlets are so fickle in a sense. And yeah, you could have a promotion on with Total Wine or whatever it is, but I don't think that has staying power. And it doesn't also necessarily help in the premium space. We want right. These wines to be poured by the glass or on the bottle lists at great restaurants. And it's, we always say we have to sell our wine three times. We have to get distributors to pick up the wines and to see value in working with them. And then we have to go work with them, train their teams, work with them to sell to restaurants and retailers. But then that's not enough either, because even if we're getting restaurants and retailers excited about the wines, if there's no one selling them to the end consumer, they're just going to sit on shelves, right? Because take Stargazer, unfortunately, because it's an amazing category, people aren't walking in and saying, what's your Tasmanian Riesling selection like? So we're trying to build up ambassadors, people who will put those wines on their list. And when people come in and say, I like German dry Riesling, or I don't know if people even say that, but, or I like great white wine and I want to try something new, and have people that are saying, oh, you got to try this Tasmanian Riesling, and just getting people to come along for the ride with these wines is it's the only way it's going to happen.
Well, there's at least one person asking about Tasmanian Riesling. I tried for like years and then I ended up giving up. So I'll bring it back. But yeah, I don't know why. Well, not, I do know why. It did taste more German to me. Then I'm just not as big into the Clare Valley Rieslings as I am the Tasmanian. They were my favorite. I did have one question on when it gets to like the higher end producers that are small production that are like cult-like in Australia, like people think Penfolds outside, and then you get in a little deeper and there's like Henschke, and they're a little more terroir driven and family owned and smaller and that way. And then you get to something like Rockford, which is like the small producer that is known for their basket press wine that's only made in small quantities. But if you talk to any local Australians, they'll be like, oh, mate, this is like the third best wine right behind Hill of Grace and Grange. How do you start like telling that story when it's like it's a cult wine there, but then they don't really export, they don't really have distribution, so you can't really tell that story outside of the country?
Yeah, and that was really something I think it's so hard to get an idea for when you don't have access for the wines. I had studied the Langton's classification, which is Australia's kind of premier auction house who does every 5 years, they release a new classification that's based on auction performance, but really sort of catalogs Australia's most important wines. But it's so hard to know when you're looking at that list is what's the difference between Torbrek's Runrig and Clonakilla's Shiraz Viognier? What's the practical difference in terms of how they taste? How do people view them? And I think that was something that's just really hard to get a context for. And that was honestly a big idea with the book, because so few of these wines are in the US and so few sommeliers or consumers are able to do significant wine travel in Australia because it's far and it's expensive. We really felt like we wanted to write this reference that people could just close the gap a little bit, that people could feel a little bit more proximity. When you're studying Australia and you're looking through your Langton's classification, you say, okay, well, what's the history? What's the deal with Mosswood or Bass Phillip? Or how can I actually put these wines in context for myself that people would be able to dig into this book and it would just, yeah, help bring them a little bit closer to Australian wine.
Yeah. No, first, I also love the Clonakilla Shiraz Viognier. I actually made my parents go with me. I went there once by myself and they visited me and I took them back because it was so good. But diving into that, I love how your book is laid out. How did you guys, were you thinking originally? Because you have, it's broken down by region and you have these producers, but then you also have like your little, I guess, icons that are like guides for everybody, like the New Guard, environmental hero, legend, those types of things. How did you decide to go maybe regional breakdown and then use those to help people get a better sense of the producers themselves?
Yeah, we definitely, regionality was really important to us because I do think Australia is too often sort of just lumped into one category in a way that like French wine isn't. You're not kind of like, oh, I like French wine. You're like, oh, I really like Burgundy and the Rhone. People get specific. Right. And you don't have these producers. You know, when I was thinking of the Louis Jadot example, I was like, well, who is like the quintessential French producer? And there really isn't one because people are so regional, right? In a way that Australia is as well, but has become defined by people think of Australia, they do think of Penfolds or Yellowtail or Molly Duker, even though these only represent a few regions and styles. So yeah, we wanted to really be able to break things down into states and regions so people could get context and get the idea that these are very distinct regions that have their own geographic features and personalities and concerns and issues and excitements, and that each had a very distinct identity, much like the wine regions of, you know, France or Italy or Spain. And so that was the impetus for really making it very regionally divided. The icons, we felt like, what's a way we can just be able to give people a glimpse at some of these, the important factors of these wineries, either because we were having to cut text and this book probably could have been another 100 pages if we let it, or just because we know the way people read and it's not always complete. Sometimes people, let's say you're visiting the Yarra Valley and you just want to flip through and see who might be good to visit, we have a must visit icon. Or if environmental practices are super important to you, then you can flip through and see who's really leaning into that. And so, yeah, that was the idea with that. And we really had a great team and a great publisher who sort of, we all came together and really felt like, what elements can we add to make this really fun, really accessible? Because we had the research and we had the text to make it a great reference book. But we wanted it also to be a great book just for someone who's curious and getting started or might visit Australia. Just what are some elements that we can add to make this a little bit more accessible? And so I think that's where a lot of the icons or the, we call them wedges, but they're like little pop-ups that go throughout that talk about how the name Shiraz came about or what are some words that Australians use to describe wine, or what's, how did bag and box culture originate in Australia, and sort of these sort of cultural glimpse into Australia. And then we added the pull out grape table, which if you just have the digital copy, you might have a hard time seeing. But in the middle of the book, there is a 4-page fold out grape table. And that was another thing where we're like, okay, if you're just, you're not a wine professional, you're just like a wine enthusiast and pulling up to this book, what might be useful? And it's, you can go to the chart, you can say, oh, I really Riesling, and you can scan and you can see that it's Clare Valley, Eden Valley, but also, oh, there's some good stuff going on in Franklin River and Tasmania and wherever else. So yeah, we were able to just execute a lot of that fun stuff with the idea of, yeah, making it useful, but also accessible no matter where you're coming at it from.
Yeah, it's the comments on all the kind of unique features, like the call outs and stuff like that. The icons are super helpful in it. I think it does blend the idea of it being a reference book with it being sort of a quick guide too. Those features help with that a ton. I don't know how much you had to do with the design of the book overall, but just aesthetically, it's a book that feels like it really welcomed into the, what I imagine to be like the culture and feel of Australia, just as a, like a destination, just like the design, the colors and all of that of the book. It's just really well put together. So kudos to the team. I don't know how much sort of influencing that, but the look and feel of it is really awesome too. And for a book of that size, to me, that's really important because it needs to be engaging all the way throughout, right? For a reference book.
Totally. We actually ended up switching publishers halfway through the process. And when we had the first meeting with the head of design at the new publisher, she just immediately got it and she was awesome. And so I will say I didn't have too much to do with the visuals. John, my husband, did a little bit more. Like he was very involved in the design of the maps and the choosing all the photography. By the time we got to that point, I was very exhausted. The text was, I was ultimately sort of responsible for all text. And John did a lot of research and writing himself, but like I was the one pulling that all together. So there were some things that it was great. We kind of had our team between the two of us that I would just be like, I don't have the energy for this. And I got it. So yeah, I gave basically a thumbs up to things. But besides that, I wasn't super involved in actually creating the design. And I'm very grateful to the people who did, because I agree, it's really awesome.
Right. As far as building interest in the region, that certainly can't hurt to have a beautifully aesthetic book. Can you just, I'm looking through in the introduction, you guys do a great job, in the table of contents, you guys do a great job at calling out and like putting the regions in full focus at the onset. This book is about country, but it's really a book about all the diversity of regions. Can you just give sort of the highest level overview that you can maybe, and then we can sort of dig a little bit deeper if it makes sense on the diversity and climate? You already spoke a little bit about there's every possible climate that you could think of to grow wine. I think if I'd come in before looking at the book or talking to you, I would have imagined that Australia is just much more monolithic. And I imagine that many other people think it's probably, you have the coast and then you have desert or super arid land.
Yeah.
And so there's that dichotomy. Can you just describe from a high level the different sort of climatic areas?
Yeah. In general, viticulture is in the sort of bottom third of the country. Really, when you get too far north in Australia, it is just too warm. And wine regions are also relatively coastal. And I say relatively, there are certainly ones that are several hundred kilometers from the coast. You have a few regions along the Murray River that are pretty inland, but have their lifeblood from the Murray River that allows them to survive. But you have, just with those limited, kind of somewhat limited factors of sort of proximity to the coast and elevation and latitude, of course, you're able to create, yeah, a lot of different climates. Some that are, yeah, quite sort of almost desert-like, and some that are really lush and green and wet If you drive from the Barossa Valley to just south to Adelaide Hills, two regions that share a border, you feel like you're in a totally different world. Adelaide Hills is, it's wet, it's high elevation, it's green, there's lots of apple and cherry orchards. Parts of the Barossa Valley, you feel like you're on the moon. It's white, sandy soils and completely flat. And when neither is better or worse, it's really just about finding the right grapes for the right sites. But yeah, one through line though, one kind of commonality to Australian wine regions is that in general, they're all quite high UV, high sunlight, which of course presents some viticultural considerations, right? In terms of like row orientation and canopy management, and you want to make sure grapes aren't getting sunburnt and stuff like that. But a lot of times it can be harnessed for real good. Take Tasmania, for example. Tasmania is, if you just look at a Winkler scale sort of heat summation perspective, Tasmania is about the same temperature as Champagne, a little bit colder. You're looking at a quite cold wine region, but Tasmania sees 1,000 more sunlight hours in a year than Champagne does. Sees the sunlight hours akin to Palm Springs, California. You get sunlight, which is really promoting phenolic flavor ripeness without corresponding sugar, temperature, heat that's encouraging sugar accumulation, which of course turns into alcohol. I got there eventually. So it really, if you think about the honestly fairly limited styles that are created in Champagne and you're not able to make a lot of still wine, Tasmania can make so many different styles. They're not doing super warm climate stuff like Grenache, Mataro, or Viognier or something like that. But yeah, just amazing, as we talked about Riesling, obviously great Chardonnay and Pinot Noir that they make as still wines as well as sparkling wines. But then you see some really great Cabernets and Syrahs, and it really, the sunlight, you get these wines that are just very flavorful, like incredible depth of flavor and complexity, but also very fresh, like incredible freshness and kind of drinkability. And I think those things aren't often thought of in the same breath. You don't talk about the most complex, great wines of the world in terms of their freshness and drinkability. You're not assigning those characteristics to Barolo or Bordeaux. Whereas I think in Australia, you're able to create wines that both have the complexity and the length and the balance that we're after in fine wine, but also just a high level of freshness and drinkability. And that's across all the different climates. So that's, I think that can't be overstated really, that Australia actually, not only is it able to sort of do everything with all these different climates, it actually does have its own unique expression because of this unique ratio of temperature to sunlight.
Yeah, and you import one of those Tasmanian cabs with the Domaine A, so everybody should check those out.
I do.
Yeah, nice. Do you also find an interesting, I guess, cultural influence in certain regions that people may not expect? Like I'm thinking kind of like Kings Valley up in like Victoria, where there are these, I think it's Kings Valley, you can correct me if the name's wrong, but where there's like an Italian community that's just been there for generations and they're growing Italian grapes, or Jim Barry's growing in Assyrtiko. I feel like there's both a cultural influence, but also a really drive for exploration, or almost like this free spirit when it comes to grapes. I think those are two things that I thought was really interesting across the board as well.
Totally. There's definitely a cultural thing with, as you mentioned, King Valley and the Italian families there, but it's almost less, becoming less cultural and more what grape's going to work best in my land. It's not so much about, oh, this is my family, these are the wines of my homeland, but more, okay, I'm Australian, I'm working with this plot of land. Oh, I'm actually like high elevation and I have some great granite in my soils or whatever it is. Like, I'm going to put Syrah in my vineyard, or I'm going to put Tempranillo in my vineyard, because I think those are going to be a really good fit. And yeah, people aren't anymore feeling limited by what's popular, what's common. Instead, it's, well, if Nerida Avila or Sagrantino or Assyrtiko or Pickpool or whatever it is going to be a good fit. Let's run with that. There really is. There's a book that just came out by Max Allen, who's a phenomenal Australian wine writer, called Alternative Varieties. I think it's called Alternative Varieties. You would be able to find it if you Googled those two things. And it's so important to the Australian wine story right now. And I think especially as climate changes, and it is changing in Australia too, some parts more than others, but it's so important to have this dexterity of what planting grapes that are going to work for the changing climate, because it's a lot of European wine regions don't have that dexterity. Burgundy is going to have a big identity crisis when it can't grow Pinot Noir and Chardonnay anymore. And I'm sure people are going to, I don't think that's happening tomorrow, but it probably is happening at some point in the future. And the good thing about Australia is there is this real dexterity, and it's happening already, where people are really trying to plant the grapes and continue to grow the grapes that are most well suited for their land.
Yeah, you put that so much better than me. After I said the cultural thing, I realized I couldn't think of anywhere else aside from King Valley. But you hit it right on the head. It's so interesting. And also, there's not even a regional. If you go to Napa right now and there are people up there, there's some Rebola Jala, but people look at them like they're insane. Like most of these regions too, you can grow whatever and your neighbor's not going to be looking at you, or a sommelier in the city who's serving the wine is not going to be like, this is a weird wine from the Yarra Valley. Sure, there's commonly planted things, but I don't feel like there's as much of a stigma for exploring as well.
No, not at all. And if you go into great wine shops in Australia, it really isn't. It isn't dominated by five grapes. There certainly is going to be more Chardonnay than Assyrtiko, but there's a real focus and appreciation for alternative grape varieties, and that's something I think we have a little bit of a hard time with in the U.S. because so often these alternative grapes are associated with regions in Europe, where people aren't necessarily coming into wine stores and asking for Sangiovese. Even they're probably asking for Chianti Classico or Brunello. And so you have almost the regions who are defining, and as a result, you don't get, the grape doesn't sort of come along for the ride. And so that's something I'm hoping that we can all grow together towards in the US, is just people, instead of just sort of resting on their laurels and saying, well, I know I like this wine, or I know I like this grape. I think it's incumbent upon us in the wine industry to get people to try new things. And it's always amazing when we're out in the world and going to new places that there's so many wine shops and wine bars and restaurants who really, you know, who put some of these alternative grapes on their by the glass lists, or do tastings so that people can try them before they buy. And that's what's going to change the dial, because unfortunately wine is like, it feels like a big commitment, right? To order a bottle of wine or buy a bottle of wine, because it is a big bummer to open a bottle of wine and then discover that you don't like it. So I understand people's sort of reservations for trying new things, but I think the industry has been pretty smart in finding ways to get these wines in front of people. And hopefully we can continue to move in that direction.
I find for me, whenever we do interviews on either producers or regions, or just someone who has expertise in an area that I haven't explored a lot, that I want to go out and right away see if I can pick something up. Are there either three regions or three producers that if someone were to leave this podcast and say, I want to explore something interesting, maybe it's something that you're drinking a lot of right now, or really just you think captures the essence of a specific area, could you throw some out there?
Yeah. Australian Grenache would be top of my list. And there are the most common regions you're going to see in the US are Barossa and McLaren Vale, which both are doing great things with Grenache right now. It was 10, 15 years ago, people made Grenache to sort of look like picture as. It was very extracted and picked late and oaked. And now people are really going the opposite way and creating these beautiful, ethereal, medium-bodied, red-fruited Grenaches that are just absolutely stunning. So yeah, I would definitely recommend picking up some Australian Grenache. And you do see it around, but I'm hoping you can see it around more and more. Italian grape varieties, I definitely have to say, you do see some in the U.S. And it's just so fun because so rarely do you get to taste these grapes outside their home regions. You know, how many people have ever tried a Nera d'Avola from anywhere but Sicily? And so as much as we are able to try Sauvignon Blancs from around the world and really see the differences there, or Pinot Noir, or Cab, or Chardonnay, or whatever it is, we've only ever tried this one grape from this one region. And so it's really exciting to be able to taste that grape elsewhere and really kind of think about what is climate and what is grape, and like separating the two in a way that hasn't been done before. And I just think there's some great value with those wines too. And then there's two that are sort of vying for the last spot in my head, so I'll mention them both quickly. Cooler climate Syrah. I think certainly Shiraz and warmer climate Barossa Valley, McLaren Vale, Shiraz gets top billing, and there are plenty of really extraordinary versions of those wines. But I think the style that's left out of the conversation more are these cooler climate Syrahs in Australia, which have all those geeky, savory flavors that we all like, the green olive and the black pepper and the game. And to me, the real difference between the Northern Rhone is often the palate. And the palates are just going back to that climate kind of ratio. You get these really fresh, soft, bright palates. And I just absolutely love it. I think regions you'd probably be looking at Adelaide Hills, Yarra Valley, Grampians. There's Macedon Ranges has some nice Syrah. We have a producer in Southern Heathcote, which is like practically in Macedon Ranges, that's making really, really amazing kind of cooler climate Syrah, more savory Syrah. So yeah, that's just and Canberra District, talk about Clonakilla. That's a great example of some cooler climate Syrah. So yeah, that would be one. And then Chardonnay. I think Australia just does Chardonnay really well across the board, where especially as some of our marquee Chardonnay regions in the world get more and more expensive, whether it's Sonoma or Napa or Burgundy, you can drink some of the very best Chardonnays in Australia, which to me are some of the very best Chardonnays in the world for $50, $60, which, yeah, is it inexpensive, but compared to the very best Chardonnays in Burgundy, it's a value. So yeah, you can't go wrong with anywhere from Tasmania to Margaret River to Adelaide Hills to Yarra Valley, Macedon Ranges. There's just a lot of exceptional Chardonnay being made in Australia right now.
I couldn't agree more with all of those recommendations. So that, thank you for that.
Awesome.
Yeah, this really appreciate you coming on. I just want to reiterate your project, How to Drink Australian. It's Jane Lopez and Jonathan Ross. It says an essential modern wine book, which it seems like it certainly is. And definitely, I think the term modern, not even just coming back to the way that you guys laid out the project, but really trying to move Australian wine into, quote unquote, I guess, the new world or the US and popularize the drinking of some of these wines. I definitely think that's a modern endeavor and one that we should continue on. So I appreciate you coming and sharing.
No, I appreciate you guys. Yeah, we'll keep spreading the gospel for Australian wine. And yeah, we appreciate you helping us get the word out there.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll stay in touch. And best of luck as the book gets broader distribution. You should be really proud.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. That was our interview with Jane Lopez. I hope everybody goes and checks out How to Drink Australian. And I hope everybody, at least even if you don't read the whole book, enjoyed our interview with her. But I think that, like I said in the intro, it's one of the most thorough and really helpful explanations of Australian wine that I've seen since I worked my harvest there. So I really recommend everybody go check it out.
And that is it for us for this week. We'll be back with another episode or another interview next week. Cheers.
To check out our current offerings and to sign up for the Vint platform, find us at www.vint.co. That's www.vint.co. For questions, comments, or feedback on the Vint podcast, please email us at support@vint.co. Vint and VV Markets are offering securities pursuant to Regulation A. Our offering circular as amended can be found on the SEC website. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investments such as those on the Vint platform are speculative and involve substantial risks to consider before investing. We may provide communication that may contain certain forward-looking statements that are subject to various risks and uncertainties. Information provided in any communications, including this podcast, is not legal, business, or tax advice. All prospective investors should consult a legal, tax, or business advisor concerning the subject matter of any communications and any offering.